Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a look back at the ecological lessons of the American Dust Bowl. But first, a check-in in Iraq. A U.S. military helicopter crashed north of Baghdad this morning, apparently shot down by insurgents. It's the third crash of a U.S. military helicopter this month. Also today, the Iraqi Election Commission said it was tossing out votes cast at 227 polling places in last month's parliamentary election. Well, for the latest from Baghdad, we've called Nelson Hernandez, reporter for The Washington Post. And Nelson, first, what else is the U.S. military saying about that helicopter crash?
U.S. military authorities in Baghdad haven't really said much about it, except that there was a crew of two, and then it crashed in the village of Mashhada, a little bit north of Baghdad. They say that the fate of the crew is unknown and that they don't really know how the aircraft went down. However, we have a special correspondent who went to the scene of the crash. He couldn't actually access the scene because the U.S. military had cordoned it off. But an Army lieutenant who wouldn't identify himself said that it was an Apache attack helicopter that crashed because it was hit by a rocket and that the crew was dead. He also said that they were looking for the perpetrators of the attack.
Well, we've heard reports that at least two insurgent groups have claimed responsibility. We also understand that the crash fits a pattern of more frequent helicopter crashes during the winter months. What else do you know about the insurgent claims?
I really don't know very much. I know the Apache is very heavily armed, and it's very hard to shoot it down.
We want to ask you also about these ballot boxes that the Iraqi Election Commission says they've thrown out. Who's been complaining about the ballot boxes? Who's likely to benefit? And will any of this, after all said and done, affect the results?
Yeah, we had a very difficult to understand press conference here in Baghdad just a couple of hours ago. The fellow talking to us was named Hussein Hindawi. He's the head of the Iraqi Electoral Commission. He tried to give us a breakdown of where exactly these complaints were, but it was kind of difficult to understand in translation. But the gist of it, what we've heard in the past, is that Sunnis were very upset with the way the election was handled. And also up in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, some minority groups who live in Iraq, like the Turkmen, were upset with not being able to vote fully. But it sounded like the majority of the complaints that were actually acknowledged were in Baghdad. You know, a few dozen of the boxes in Baghdad were thrown out. But the general gist of this is that this probably isn't going to have a very big effect on the outcome of the election in the country.
Well, while we have you there in Baghdad, we want to check briefly on other news. What's been the response to the resignation this weekend of the judge in the Saddam Hussein trial? He claimed personal reasons, not government pressure. He had been getting a lot of criticism. What are people saying?
The latest I've heard on that story is that other judges and the government, members of the government, are asking him to return to office. And I understand from a Western diplomat I spoke to a few days ago about this very subject, that up to three times in the past, he's made similar, you know, threats of leaving office. And at least at one point, during one of those times, he had actually submitted a letter of resignation, but later retracted it. I think if he does wind up leaving for real, it won't slow down the trial a whole lot. It's because another member of the five-member tribunal will just step up and become chief judge.
And Nelson, what do you make of the story in the New York Times today that more than 2,000 U.S. Army MPs will now be working right alongside Iraqi police officers to try to train them? It's an effort that's just now starting and would seem to put those U.S. troops in pretty vulnerable situations next to the Iraqi police officers, very vulnerable and under attack from insurgents.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting story because the U.S. military and actually, you know, U.S. officials in general have been repeatedly saying that 2006 will be the year of the police in Iraq. They've done a lot of what sounds like pretty good work with the Iraqi army, but they really want to apply their focus to the police now. These police forces are just infiltrated by local insurgents or intimidated by them in such a way that they wind up working for the insurgents themselves. And so a lot of money and equipment that we poured into building up these police forces, you know, wound up with the insurgents themselves.
And Nelson, one last question. Is there any more news about freelance journalist Jill Carroll, who was kidnapped in Baghdad on January 7th?
We haven't heard any news at all, really, about Jill Carroll. and we would like to hear something about her. We miss her.
Nelson Hernandez, he's a reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Baghdad. Well, when I heard we were going to spend some time today on the Depression-era Dust Bowl, I thought, well, that could be interesting. In the hands of author Tim Egan, it's riveting.
The windows of houses were covered with wet sheets and blankets, the doors taped, the wall cracks stuffed with rags and newspapers. Men avoided shaking hands with each other because the static electricity was so great it could knock another person down. They also put cloth on their doorknobs and metal oven handles to inhibit the electric jolt. Car owners used chains, dragging them along the street as a ground for the electricity in the air. Hospitals postponed operations because they could not keep their surgical wards clean. And flour mills in Kansas had to curtail work because the dust mingled with grain.
Imagine dust storms 2 miles high, cows producing brown milk, mothers crying muddy tears over infants dying because their lungs are filled with dirt. This is a picture of the American plains in the 1930s, a time associated with John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath, the story of the Jode family's exodus from Oklahoma to California. But while many people did leave, most stayed, and theirs is the story Tim Egan tells in his book, The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Great American Dust Bowl. Tim joins us now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. And Tim, you remind us that the Dust Bowl stretched from the panhandles of Texas and Oklahoma to parts of New Mexico and Colorado, and was once a fertile grassland.
Yeah, it was just an Eden. I mean, imagine being able to see this place 150 years ago. People wrote rhapsodically about it. Lewis and Clark, when they went on their expedition and came back in 1806 and toured through the grasslands, they were just, some of their most lyrical passages were about that. And Walt Whitman called it that ever-recurring miracle, the grasslands. And, you know, it was an ocean of grass. It just stretched forever. Mm. And even in dry years, it was a pretty good place because there was always some forage for animals. And so it had the 20 million members of the southern bison herd. And that's why people first started to come there as well.
But the bison were cleared out.
Yeah. In less than a generation's time, probably 15 years, the bison were cleared out. The Indians who still lived there and thought that they had that land, it's south of the Arkansas River, north of the Red River, they thought that land was theirs by treaty. The treaty was broken. They were moved to outside of Lawton, Oklahoma. So interestingly, at the start of the 20th century, you had this huge hole in the United States, and the census measured exactly zero people in the Texas Panhandle, which was a big part of the Dust Bowl. Zero.
And it became a part of this great land grab. Everyone from the government to real estate speculators encouraging people to go to this land and turn the grassland under, plow it under.
They came because they could own something, and that was a really big deal. The slogan was, every man a landlord. And over the course of about 20 years, at the early start of the 20th century, we had all these towns just rose, and people went overnight from living in sod houses, living in dugouts, to making a fairly decent living on this land.
Because they were selling wheat. They had turned over all the grassland. As you say, they were sod busters. They'd busted the sod, planted the wheat, and people needed the wheat.
And not only that, the rains came. So it was a green period down there. And, you know, they made the mistake that we always make, that humans have always made, is which when things are going good, you think they'll go this way all the time. It did work for a while.
But then at a certain point, the demand for the wheat dropped off and a drought came. The rain stopped. But before that, people, as you said, did come because it was a jewel of a place. You met people who either knew these people or you met people directly who were still, you know, still living in this land. Tell us about one of them, Hazel Shaw.
Hazel was a remarkable woman. She came with this big clan from the South, and they moved up. It was the everyman a landlord syndrome. They got a little piece of Oklahoma dirt. They're coming up by horse-drawn wagon into Oklahoma territory. It was a hard place to love, a tableau for mischief and sudden death from the sky or up from the ground. Hazel Lucas, a daring little girl with straw-colored hair, first saw the grasslands near the end of a family journey to claim a homestead. She got up on the tips of her toes in the horse-drawn wagon to stare into an abyss of beige. It was as empty as the back end of a day, a wilderness of flat. The family then clawed a hole in the side of the prairie just south of Boy City. It was not the promised land Hazel had imagined, but it had possibility.
Tim Egan reading from his new book about the Dust Bowl. But even then, it was such a hardscrabble life. I mean, you write about people living in these dugout holes with, you know, bugs in the walls and tough life.
One of the families I profiled, the mother would iron the walls as a way to kill bugs who were always crawling around between there. But then people built plank houses during the good years, and they thought, you know, it's we're on our way. We have something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what broke that was the start of the 1930s.
The 1930s, which saw not only the Great Depression nationwide, but, as we said, no more demand for the wheat that the people had planted and the drought. What happened to the land because it had been overturned and used for wheat?
This was a drought that started in 1931, and it was a bad one. It lasted a long time. It was probably the worst of the century. But the plains has always had droughts. And the winds did blow quite fiercely for most of the year, especially in the early spring and late winter. But the winds always blow on the Great Plains. It's just part of the climate, part of the ecosystem. What was different now, Robin, was that the grass was gone. Without anything to hold the ground down, though, without any grass, when the drought came, it didn't even get the wheat up in the spring, the land was fallow. And as the wind blew and as the soil calcified, this dirt took to the sky in great mountainous swoops.
Just unbelievable scenes that you paint of people breathing it in, trying to drive through it.
Everyone would put Vaseline in their nostrils as a filter. They had the Red Cross distributed these masks that people all wore before they went outside. Of course, they'd quickly get dirty. They taped their windows down at night with bed sheets. They'd wet them down, I should say, that would become muddy in the morning. And people said time and again that when you woke up in the morning, the only thing in your house that was not covered with a fine layer of dust was the little outline of where your head had rested on the pillow at night before. People told me when they cooked, they would only turn the pots up just before you cooked, and then you'd turn it back down again. You'd milk a cow in the water, and the milk would be somewhat muddied. Their animals would go blind because dust would get in their eyes. You'd do an autopsy and you'd find their stomachs were all bound up with it. Children would die of this horrible thing the doctors called dust pneumonia. And it was basically their young lungs were just filled up with dirt, as one of the doctors said.
Given this, Tim Egan, you write about the people who stayed. Why did they stay?
Yeah, it's a great question. And by the way, most of them did stay. And the reason they stayed was twofold. One is they had something, and that meant something. They had a piece of dirt, and they thought, this can't go on forever. And they were afraid of the city. They'd go to the movies in their little town and see these newsreels of people waiting in line to get soup and people selling apples for 5 cents a pop and stories of suicides on Wall Street. And they were really afraid of the city. They thought, at least in the country we have something. We can raise a pig and slaughter it, or we can grow something. And the second thing was, they thought it had to get better. They were called tomorrow people. You know, when you're in the middle of something like this, you don't know you're in the middle of an epic siege. You think it's temporary. You think it has to end, but it lasted most of 10 years.
Author Tim Egan, his compelling new book is The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Great American Dust Bowl. We're going to take a break. When we come back, how this ecological disaster changed lives, yes, but also changed America. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. Welcome back to Here and Now, and we're continuing our conversation with author Tim Egan. His book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. And Tim, I want to talk about the day that changed the Dust Bowl and changed America. It was April 14th, 1935. It became known as Black Sunday because on that day, the worst dust storm of all hit, and it hit hard, carrying more than 300 tons of dirt out of the West. Can you just read us a passage that describes what it was like to see it approach?
My God, here it comes. Dodge City went black. The front edge of the duster looked 2,000 feet high. Winds were clocked at 65 miles an hour. A few minutes earlier, there had been bright sunshine and a temperature of 81 degrees, without a wisp of wind. Drivers turned on their headlights now, but could not see ahead of them, or even see the person sitting next to them. It was like three midnights in a jug, one old nester said. Cars died, their systems shorted out by the static. People fled to tornado shelters, fire stations, gyms, church basements. There was a whiff of panic, not evident in earlier storms, as a fear took hold that the end was near. A woman in Kansas said she thought of killing her child to spare the baby the cruelty of Armageddon.
And this storm, this Black Sunday storm, also went up and down the coast. It approached Washington. It reminds us this Dust Bowl occurred because of a land rush, people in the government included, encouraging people to rush and take land in this area and rip out the grass and plant wheat. But there were detractors of that. One of them is a soil scientist named Hugh Bennett, and he's making a presentation to the Senate trying to make the case for a massive soil conservation project when the big storm comes by.
Yeah, this is a fascinating convergence of policy and natural disaster, or human man-caused disaster, I should say. Bennett, who was a scholar, but also, you know, a man of the people, sort of commoner, who's really had a good gift of gab and knew how to tell a story, was speaking to the Senate a few days after Black Sunday, and he'd heard that the residue of the storm was making its way east. And as he spoke, he tried to sort of filibuster and drag it out, and aide came and whispered in his ear and said, "It's almost here. Keep going." So he, you know, palavered for a while and kept talking, and then a half hour went by and they said, keep going, it's almost here. At last, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they looked outside and the sky did darken, and Bennett rose, told everyone to look outside and said, "There it is, that's what I've been talking about. There goes Oklahoma." And the Senate approved that day of the measure to create the Soil Conservation Service. FDR signed it the next day, and to this day, the Soil Conservation Service is the only New Deal grassroots organization left over from the 1930s, the only grassroots organization left. And people think it was largely responsible for why the land didn't take off in later droughts.
I'm wondering, you know, we started by saying that you met some of the people who were some of the survivors. I'm thinking of Ike Osteen. Is he the one who came out when you went up to him and he said, "You're here to talk about the drought"? How do they say it?
They all call it the drought. Yeah, it's just an aberration of a dialect.
Just the way they say it. But I'm wondering, of those who are survivors or their children, do they blame themselves?
It's a great question. They have a real mixed view. They didn't need the pioneering ecologists of the New Deal to come out. They didn't need Hugh Bennett to come out and tell them, as Hugh Bennett said at one speech, that they had committed suicide on the land. A lot of them knew what they were doing was pushing it. And it's, you know, it was simple hubris. The price was so good.
Well, and I was going to say, and the government was encouraging them. In fact, there were subsidies to some of these farmers to keep growing the wheat that nobody would buy.
Yeah, they gave them extraordinary incentives to get out there. I mean, the railroads were all taking them out there for free. The government, as I said earlier, had enlarged the Homestead Act, deliberately trying to populate this part. And they sent out these edicts, plant more wheat, plant as much as you can. We'll sell it as soon as you can get it up and get it to market. But one of the ironies is at a time when 25% of Americans were out of work and when people were literally starving. I mean, they sent a telegram from Boy City, Oklahoma, to the Congress saying, "In desperate need of help, 80% of us in semi-starvation right now." Mm. At a time when that was going on, wheat was rotting by the side of the railroad tracks because there wasn't any market for it, and you could only do so much with it.
So, Tim Egan, what is another lesson of the Dust Bowl?
Well, I think it's an ancient lesson. I really do. I think it goes back to the Greeks, and it goes back to things our parents and grandparents told us, which is, you know, if you push nature too hard, it will push back. It has a breaking point. And we like to think we learned this, but then you see disasters happen over and over again. And this was a classic tale of hubris. They pushed too hard, and then the natural world broke down.
Mm. Tim Egan, correspondent with the New York Times, his new book about the American Dust Bowl is called The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, which, as we said, Tim, happened, you know, during the Depression. And I just happened to note in the foreword you dedicated this to your dad, raised by his widowed mother during the darkest years of the Great Depression, 4 to a bedroom.
My father was, raised by a single mother in a little apartment in Chicago. He's Irish Catholic and never had any money. And it's a nice fulfillment of my dreams to be able to dedicate this book to him.
I mean, we've spoken of the lesson of the Dust Bowl. You note a lesson imparted from him.
Yeah, I say that he raised 7 kids when he raised us, my family. And we never saw him sweat. And I learned later it was hit some pretty hard times himself. But the interesting thing that comes out of this, you can't do a book on the Depression and not come away and feel how lucky we are with at least our material comforts. You think of a time when people lived with earthen floors and they were eating canned and brined tumbleweed, and there was no Social Security. There was no safety net. They had no idea what tomorrow was going to bring them. They'd butchered their very last farm animal and ate, as they used to say, everything but the squeal after they butchered a hog.
You wrote of another scene where a young farmhand walks into a hospital and the doctor takes a look at him and says, "You're filled with dirt, you're going to die," and he dies.
And he died a few days later. He said, "Son, you're just filled up with dirt." So one of the lessons is I hope I won't complain anymore about any material discomfort.
It's called The Worst Hard Time. Tim Egan, thanks so much.
Oh, I absolutely enjoyed this. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, President Bush steps in to rescue the brand new Medicare prescription plan after seniors can't get their medications and angry states are picking up the tab. Plus, the man known as Britain's answer to Bob Dylan left the stage decades ago. Now Donovan is back. We'll speak with him. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Africa's first elected female head of state was sworn into office today in Liberia.
As President of the Republic of Liberia, my government extends a hand of friendship and solidarity to the leadership and members of all political parties that have been
67-year-old Ellen Johnson Sirleaf today became president of Liberia. She's a Harvard-educated woman who's pledging to unite the country after 14 years of war. First Lady Laura Bush of the U.S. and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice also attended the ceremony. Mrs. Bush said the United States stands behind Sirleaf, and American aid will help the country bring basic services such as electricity and water to its citizens. Liberia's legacy of war has led to widespread poverty and a life expectancy of just 41 years for men, 42 years for women. Well, we had a chance to speak with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf when she visited Boston as a candidate to raise money for her presidential bid. I asked her then where she would start to make changes in Liberia if she were to win.
We start with, first of all, trying to ensure peace, stability, and reconciliation. And that means, you know, being able to put together a team, a government that reflects the diversity of our population. You know, reaching out to all of those who have been affected by the civil wars, trying to put the past behind us, you know, as ugly as that past is.
How do you get the most basic things accomplished? Water, jobs, good sewage systems. I mean, all the systems that have broken down. How do you jumpstart that?
In the first instance, we need to manage our own resources properly. Mm-hmm. We've not done that. Corruption has taken away from any effort to restore basic services to the people. So we're going to do that.
Well, you have a diamond industry, timber exports.
Liberia is amply endowed, and Liberia's population of 3 million, small. There's no reason for our country to be poor the way it is and for our people to suffer the way they have. Mm. If we manage our resources properly and we create the environment whereby there's confidence, not only for Liberians to return home, which is our greatest asset anyway, but where we'd be able to attract private capital, private investment, because we have a government that's responsive, I believe that it's not going to be a long period of time before the basic things to which you refer, water, lights, you know, the repair of our infrastructure like roads, our schools and our health systems, that we can do it. Our country is not poor. Our country has just had poor leadership.
Can I ask you something related to the history? You mentioned reconciliation, and I'm curious. As we said, Liberia, founded by freed American slaves who went there in 1821, declared independence in 1847. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
And then pretty much ruled the country until the 1980 coup, when then Sergeant Doe overthrew the existing government. But these freed slaves and their descendants who ruled the country until 1980 were a minority. It was mostly indigenous Africans in the country, correct?
That's correct. And you know, that's one of our problems, that one of the historical contributors to to the problem we face today and to the civil wars that have wrecked our countries. Because we did have a small group representing the settler population that monopolized power and privilege to the exclusion of the majority indigenous group. Over time, that has diminished, you know, intermarriage, the ward system, education. And in fact, it's that cleavage in the society that led to the radicalization of the society in the 1960s, and that set the basis for the coup d'etat
in 1980.
Now, we've got to not only accept that history because we can't change it, but we've got to confront it. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be able to make sure that this very small minority of so-called Americo-Liberians, you know, representing the settler population, make sure that they're just another group of Liberians. They have no right to any special privileges. In fact, they do not even have the power anymore to do it.
But you also have to protect them from...
That's right. That's right. And that's very important what you say, that even though historically they may have had those who monopolize power, you have young ones among them who are not claiming any entitlement to anything else but being a Liberian and wanting to share equally and be protected equally like any other Liberian. Mm-hmm. And that's our challenge. That's our goal.
Yeah, I would think so, because that inequality set off the first coup in 1980, and the country's been spiraling ever since.
That's correct.
It would seem as if you can't quite get back on track until that's addressed.
I mean, and we have other kinds of cleavages in a society. We had an attempt for the domination and monopolization of power by one tribe, you know, when mm-hmm. President Doe was in power. We've had recently cleavages on religious grounds, you know, Muslims against Christians. Our challenge and our objective is to bring all Liberians together as Liberians, irrespective of tribe, religion, background, and for us to have a national identity in which we subscribe to the notion that Liberia comes first.
May I just ask, what is your background? Of which side are you descendant?
I do not come from the settler class, even though one may think differently when you see my complexion.
What does that mean? Your complexion is lighter than...
My complexion is light. Uh-huh. And people tend to equate anyone with light complexion with those that come from the settlers group, but that's not true. I come from a 75% Native background. My father was 100% Native of the Gola tribe. My mother was 50% Native of the Kru tribe. But I have a paternal German grandfather, and that's where this comes from.
But that lineage might be perfect for the Liberia that you're talking about, of pulling these different factions together.
You know, that's exactly what I say. I say I represent a Liberian of diversity. You know, I have a Native background. Both of my grandmothers were illiterate up until the time they died. I lived in the village during school periods, but both my mother and father, born to village life, lived in the families of Americo-Liberians. And that's how come they were able to get an education. That's how come they were able to become, if you may, even part of the elite group through an education. And that's how come I may have benefited more than, say, the average Liberian. So I represent, you know, a bridging of all that Liberia represents. And I hope that brings to me a special sensitivity and a special commitment to uniting Liberia and to reconciling us and to having us move forward as one people, committed nevermore to fight with each other, but to put our national interests above everything and work for the place where all Liberians are proud to be Liberians.
Helen Johnson Sirleaf, speaking with Here and Now when she was still a candidate for president of Liberia. She was sworn in today as Africa's first female president. Still ahead, new tributes to Martin Luther King Jr. You're listening to Here and Now. A
new study in the journal Nature claims that frogs are disappearing at an alarming rate and global warming is to blame. Researchers say emissions from cars and smokestacks promote a deadly fungus that's wiped out some frog populations in Central and South America and is driving other species to extinction. We're joined on the line by Andy Dobson. He's a professor of evolutionary biology at Princeton University. He wrote an editorial accompanying the study in Nature. Welcome, Professor Dobson.
Good afternoon.
And what exactly did the study find?
What the study showed was that climate change throughout the world, but particularly its effects on the mountainous regions of Central America, are making conditions ideal for the transmission of a fungal pathogen that's very pathogenic to frogs.
It's very deadly. And what is that weather pattern? What does the weather do?
Well, it's a combination of two things. One is increased cloudiness that increases the humidity of these mountainous regions, and it's also a slight warming of the lower areas. And what that does is it creates ideal conditions for the transmission of this fungus, which essentially suffocates the frogs once it's contacted them and infected them.
Well, of course, you know, there are critics, other scientists, who believe that global warming, you know, there's really not enough proof that it has something to do with the death of the frogs. They say, for instance, isn't it possible that this fungus could be spread just because of the trade of frogs?
Right. Well, what has happened, there are two things going on here. There is the spread globally of the fungus from its original South African origin. And this seems to tie in that the original host of this fungus is the midwife toad, Xenopus, that is widely used to produce a substance that's used in pregnancy testing. And as pregnancy testing became available in the 50s and 60s, there was a huge trade in Xenopuses. So that's probably how the fungus spread around the world. However, it's only in certain areas of the world that the climate is ideal for the transmission of the fungus. And climate change has focused those areas into Central America, parts of Latin America, and also along the sort of coastal forests of Australia. And that's where the fungus is doing the most damage.
Right. Well, and by the way, setting aside the question as to how they've become extinct, why is it important that they have?
Frogs, like anything, have an equally unique evolutionary history to we do. Mm-hmm. So any one of those frogs is the equivalent of all of Homo sapiens in terms of its evolutionary importance. If we're doing things to the environment that increase the risk that frogs die of disease, we should be much more worried about diseases that might affect humans or our domestic livestock or our crops. Mm-hmm. So they provide a very important early warning system. In the forest themselves, they themselves are predators on other species that might suddenly become pests in the absence of frogs.
We'll have pictures of them on our website, here-now.org. Can you describe them for us?
Well, they're wonderful. I mean, the classic thing about these frogs is that if you go to lots of children's books, one of the first species they can recognize after their own teddy bear is some of these frogs. They are beautifully colored. They're like little jewels. They're golds, greens, yellows, bright oranges. Very, very pretty.
Do you think, again, we've said there's some criticism of this study, but where would you place this report? Obviously, you strongly back it, but where do you put this?
Well, I think it's the strongest piece of evidence we've seen to date of how climate interacts with an ecological system, not just to affect one species, but a whole range of species over a wide geographical area. In the past, we've seen examples of climate change perhaps causing changes in when plant species start flowering in the spring, times when birds arrive from migration. That there's massive amount of evidence of that, of animals changing their behavior in response to climate change. Here we've seen a whole group of species actually go extinct, and there's no other explanation for those extinctions. So it's, you know, very damning evidence that what we're doing to the atmosphere is having a detrimental effect on all the non-voting species on the planet.
Do you think there'll be a day when we look back and say, oh, we should remember when the frogs started disappearing?
I think that day will come pretty soon. I mean, it's sounding an alarm bell that suggests we should be taking the whole climate change debate and what it's going to do to our health and our economy much more seriously.
Andy Dobson, a professor of evolutionary biology at Princeton University. And remember, you can see pictures of those frogs at our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Millions of people are remembering the late civil rights leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., on this holiday set aside to honor him. Had he not been gunned down in Memphis in 1968, King would have been 77 years old on his birthday yesterday. Among those paying tribute to Dr. King is a fellow winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, John Hume, who's speaking today at Boston University, where King earned his doctorate in divinity. John Hume is known as one of the architects of the peace process in Northern Ireland. As a leader of the country's largest nationalist party, Hume and Ulster Unionist David Trimble were co-recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1998. Hume calls King a great hero.
We were very impressed by him in Northern Ireland because in 1968 we founded the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland to work for peace and justice for our people. He was obviously a very inspirational person in that regard.
The Reverend Martin Luther King first became known nationwide here in the U.S. during the Montgomery bus boycott, which started after Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in the front of the bus to a white person in December 1955. The U.S. Supreme Court eventually ruled that segregation on Montgomery City buses was unconstitutional. Black people could sit wherever they chose. But Dr. King knew that was not the end of the civil rights struggle.
If we wait for it to work itself out, it will never be worked out. Freedom only comes through persistent revolt, through persistent agitation, through persistently rising up against the system of evil. The bus protest is just the beginning.
The Reverend Martin Luther King speaking at the end of the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama in 1956. Well, among the many tributes to King today is a special concert at Jordan Hall in Boston tonight. The event unites children's choirs from three major cities, the Boston Children's Chorus, the Young People's Chorus of New York City, and the Chicago Children's Choir. The program will include the premiere of a new work, a song cycle called Trilogy of Dreams, composed by Rollo Dilworth. During rehearsal, Here and Now's Matt Largie spoke with some kids from the Boston Children's Chorus and their artistic director, Darren Daly.
There are four sets in our program. The first set is focusing on songs of love, gratitude, and service. The second set focuses on songs of freedom. The third set is songs of the civil rights movement. And the last set is singing the dream. Singing the Dream is actually a world premiere for us. The title of the piece is Trilogy of Dreams. It's a song cycle of three Langston Hughes poems. The first poem is called The Dream Keeper. And essentially the chorus, these young people, are serving as the Dream Keeper.
Hi, I'm Hubie Jones, and I'm president of the board of the Boston Children's Chorus and founder of the chorus. It's appropriate to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy through song because he came out of a religious Baptist tradition where music is a very important part of the spiritual life. And of course, music was a very important part of the civil rights movement. I mean, it was the anthems of the civil rights movement that sort of carried the spirit and the momentum of rallies and marches and protest movements of all kinds. So it's very, very appropriate.
The second movement is Dreams, and the recurring theme throughout that is hold fast to your dreams. The kids get it. They get the text. But when you take music, powerful music, great music, and pair it with a great text through the voices of innocent children, it has an extraordinary impact on the audience. And the kids recognize the power of their singing, what they have to express.
Hi, my name is Eddie Dodson, and I'm 12 years old and live in Brighton, Massachusetts. I'm Sherilyn Seely. I'm 15 years old, and I live in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts.
What does the Dream Trilogy mean to you?
It means to me that we all have dreams, and we should all make it our goals to aspire them. Because, as you know, we are singing it on Martin Luther King Day, and he did have a dream.
Eddie, what does the music mean to you?
Well, to me, it means that it's kind of like in the Civil Rights Movement, people sang together to feel strong, and we sing together to kind of carry on that dream.
Hi, my name is Julia Hanlon. I'm 14 years old and live in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
What do you think it means to celebrate Martin Luther King Day?
I think it's to honor him and at the same time do what he wants, in a way. Like, to represent him through our music and to bring his dreams of having kids from everywhere come together, and we're sort of promoting his dreams, even though he's not here to do that.
Do you think Martin Luther King's work is finished? Do you think his goals have been achieved?
There's been an improvement since when he stated all of his goals. However, we could still do a lot more.
Eddie, what do you think?
I think that they can never be accomplished because it's to keep going forever. You can't stop and fulfill it. You just keep carrying it on.
The King message is still relevant because we have a world that is filled with conflict. Everywhere you look across the globe, there is conflict, very serious conflict, with people's lives being lost as a result of it. So the King message that you can't drive out hate with hate, you can only drive out hate with love, is a message that needs to be embraced and practiced by peoples all over the world.
The last movement is called I Dream a World, and it talks about what the children really see as being their dream world. I dream a world where black or white, whatever race you be, will know the bounties of the earth, and every man will be free. And that's what we close our portion of the concert with.
The reason we are doing this is to try to find a way to elevate the King holiday to a new level of social significance and vibrancy. All you've been having over the last 3 or 4 years is the playing of the I Have a Dream speech over and over again. In some ways, that's getting old and tiresome. So we have to find new ways that are very powerful and compelling to get people to take time to engage with each other and to think about the legacy of King.
Hubie Jones, founder of the Boston Children's Chorus. The group will be featured at a special Martin Luther King Jr. concert in Boston tonight. Also performing are the Young People's Chorus of New York City and the Chicago Children's Choir. Our story was produced by Here and Now's Matt Largy. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.